that was a bit of journalism I could never quite deal with comfortably. He got me on the front page of Gay News. I have to say, there are some bloody awful newsreaders around these days.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moment series in which we hear from those who made a difference. Bill Bingham.
I was born in Bournemouth, although I moved to Leeds when I was 3 years old, so I consider myself, I identify, should I say, as a northerner. Because after we were in Leeds for some years and I was educated there, we moved over to Liverpool. I went to Leeds Grammar School, and it was a fine school. It is still a fine school, and academically quite good. I did all right. I eventually moved to another school in Leeds, Leeds Central High School, where I took the O-levels. And I did all right, I guess. Tell you what, I was really good at science. Really, really good. Ludicrously good. I could have been a scientist in my career if I hadn't done what I'm doing these days. If ever there was a science test, I was asked to actually stand at the front when the answers were given out, and instead of actually doing the test, he asked the questions aloud, and I wrote the answers on the board for everybody. I was very proud of that, I must say. Leeds still is a great place. The sort of social life that we had was pretty extensive. I did have some good friends who were at the school, but who were at other schools too. I played rugby, I played cricket. So I was a reasonably cheery, amiable, sociable kind of person. And, I'm not used to talking about this sort of thing, I must say. So this is all really slightly uncomfortable area, but no, I think I was okay.
This is the BBC Home Service. Hello, children everywhere.
While I was in Leeds, we listened to The Wireless. And do you know, I won a Children's Hour competition. I have a letter somewhere. I've been scraping around to try and find it, because it's a very sweet little letter saying, congratulating me and saying if I won two more exhibitions, I'd win a Children's Hour silver pencil. There was also something I remember quite vividly, an early demonstration of stereo sound by the BBC. Had to go to a neighbour's house because he had two radios. One was tuned to the Home Service and one to the Light programme, I think, or the third programme, something like that.
Well, you need two receivers to hear this broadcast stereophonically. The one on the left should be tuned to Network 3, preferably on VHF, and the right-hand receiver to BBC television sound. The loudspeakers should be about the same height from the floor and spaced 6 to 10 feet apart.
And this amazing sound of a train rushing across from one side to the other was my first experience of stereo. We also listened to Radio Luxembourg in those days. We all remember Horace Batchelor, K-E-Y-N-S-H. A.M.
Horace Batchelor, Department 3, Keynsham, spelt K-E-Y-N-S-H-A-M.
He was a pools expert. Well, he claimed to be anyway. I know I wasn't old enough to try it.
Last Saturday again, we had quite a number of surprise draws.
When I was in Liverpool, I was a teenager and obviously part of the music scene in the early 1960s. I say obviously because everyone wanted to be in a group. And we were, some of us were. I played bass guitar. I played in a rock and roll band. We played a lot of Carl Perkins and Chuck Berry. I sang all the Chuck Berry songs. And we appeared in the Cavern once or twice, even when the Beatles were playing there. I can remember watching the Beatles. This is long before they were big. From the dressing room in the Cavern. We were on the same bill as them, the Rory Storm, the Big Three. It was a wonderful time. It was very exciting. And it was really a reason to try and meet girls, I have to say. We were also thrilled in those days by Radio Caroline. It just began. There was a Radio Caroline North. I remember listening to Tony Blackburn. I actually got to meet him years later. But I can remember the thrill of listening to him. It was so exciting. Really exciting times.
And talking about Radio Caroline, it's really great. I've been kind of going around the Essex area particularly lately, and it's great to hear so many of you saying how much you're enjoying the programmes from Radio Caroline. And
we spent lots of time on the phone. In those days, there were only landlines, obviously. And we did spend literally hours on the telephone chatting. And someone did once say, yes, you do have a nice voice, but it never occurred to me I would ever use it. My first job was as a bank clerk. This was my father's profession. But I was unsatisfied, and I met the woman I was to become married to. We were actually in a play, an amateur production of the Coventry Mystery Plays. I'd moved to Coventry by then with the bank, and met her when the new Coventry Cathedral had been consecrated a couple of years before, and they staged the Mystery Plays. Now, these are plays that were written in the Middle Ages and were performed by amateur actors, and they were very much in the vernacular, very simple speech. And I met this young woman, Mary. She was cast as Eve, and I was cast as Adam. Now, is that wonderful? And we got married, and we had three kids together. Dear Mary. And she was an actress. She was actually a professional actress who went on to become a teacher. And she recommended to me that I become a teacher as well. And I went to college for 3 years to learn to teach drama and English. Whilst I was doing that, I actually got involved with the Birmingham Repertory Theatre. I was getting bits of work as walk-ons and, you know, small parts, but also as a stage manager. And as a result of that, I was asked to go to the newly opened Pebble Mill in Birmingham, where they were doing a lot of television drama. It was great stuff because a lot of new writers were involved. There's a lot of stuff coming out of Pebble Mill. Play for Today, Second City First. I even got a part in Doctor Who. Tom Baker was regenerated as the Doctor. It was shot at the BBC's Engineering Training Centre at Wood Norton near Evesham. And I was in something called Robot, which was Tom Baker's first appearance. Brilliant.
Good morning, everybody. This is BBC Radio Birmingham, your local radio station.
Radio Birmingham was in the same building as Pebble Mill. That had recently opened. They invited me to be Uncle Bill and present the children's programme Radio Brum Club. That led to a weekend breakfast show on Saturdays before the legendary Ross and Henry show, a wonderfully busy and unpredictable show, quite anarchistic. Les Ross and John Henry taught me a great deal about the radio business and about music.
5, 4, 3, 2...
Q Tom.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of Midlands Today, which tonight comes to you for the very first time from our new broadcasting centre here at Pebble Mill, Birmingham.
Pebble Mill was this wonderful new piece of architecture just south of the centre of Birmingham City. The studio desks at Radio Birmingham were the wonderful grey things with round faders. Quite complicated, actually, because you had two feeds into one of these faders so that you could isolate a phone call, for example, if you were doing a phone-in programme. It took a while to get used to how to deal with this, and you sometimes forgot what you'd switched and hadn't switched, and things didn't always work. They had a terrific newsroom, I remember, at Radio Birmingham. And a lot of the journalists there went on to pretty great things. There was a fellow called Paul Vaughan, who was one of the journos. He's now a very senior agent. He represents quite a lot of... He represented Anton Deck for a while, and Chris Tarrant is one of his artists, and I think he's a very rich man as a result. It was an exciting place. Radio Birmingham was... Now, I've forgot, what was the fellow? I can't remember. I'd have to look up the name of the station manager. But he was a very gentle pair of hands, and we were given pretty free rein up to a point. I mean, the BBC had quite strong systems in place for their local radio. Les Ross and John Henry were the ones who were given almost a tiswas bit of a leash. They could do pretty much what they liked. They even had people piling into the rather small studios on a Saturday morning, making lots of noise, but it was good, exciting stuff.
We've got a lot of listeners together, and it's been great fun working alongside you, because you've been with Birmingham for around 4 years, haven't you, Les?
How long?
Is it four?
Four and a half years.
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot the half. Yes,
forgot the half.
Four and a half.
That was the bit that did it.
The premises were very modern. There was a lovely cafe, canteen, and bar. We hung out there a lot. I was getting the best of both, really, the theatrical side, the drama side, with the fleeting appearances in various plays for Today, and also beginning what became a full-time radio career. whilst I lived in Birmingham, I broke my leg on a motorbike. So I was all strapped up and on crutches, and Les Ross and I, at John Henry's suggestion, went up to Liverpool on the train to meet Gillian Reynolds, who was starting a new station to be called Radio City. Now, Gillian, as everyone knows, is an extraordinary journalist and writer and commentator and critic. She hired me, I'm delighted to say, despite the gammy leg, to do The Late Show. It's eventually called Downtown. When we arrived to start work at Radio City a month or so before we were due to open in October 1974, a couple of months, I'd say, it would have to be, it was a bit of a mess. I think the newsroom was pretty well established. They had the teleprinters there and the desks and the typewriters. The studios were still being constructed. And much of what we prepared, the trailers and the test transmissions, we made in studios with wires hanging out of the ceiling or out of the floor, coming out of the floor. The desks were just about working. But, yeah, it was a mess. We worked our socks off. We had hardly any sleep. I can remember falling asleep in the corner of the studio between voiceover sessions, but perfectly happy about it because it was all so thrilling.
6 a.m. on Monday, October the 21st, Merseyside will have its very own 24-hour-a-day radio station. Radio City will be broadcasting 24 hours a day, 365 days a year from Liverpool to more than 2 million people in the greater Merseyside area. News, local, national and international, on the hour, every hour. Music from Eric Clapton to Crumhorns.
The policy that Gillian and the managing director, Terry Smith, envisaged was pretty obvious: to engage Liverpool. Liverpool had Merseyside, of course, Radio Merseyside, which had been going for some little time and was very popular. We had to try and match what they were doing and perhaps do it even better. And I think we did, because we were given opportunities to not just play music, but to go out and talk to people. The policy and the documentary policy, which was quite thrilling, was that we could, in fact, explore stories from Liverpool's history in a greater depth than perhaps Merseyside was able to do. There was a sense of competition, inevitably, but it was a friendly competition, and I can remember meeting one or two of the blokes from Merseyside and exchanging notes, as it were. But it was a music station. It reflected some of the top 40 to some extent. So I was playing music that I really liked. I mean, I had to obviously keep an eye on what was contemporary and popular, but we weren't playing pop music. I was playing rock, jazz, contemporary, classical. And best of all, I was inviting musicians and actors to come in after playing their shows to talk to me. And you can imagine, in those days, it was an exciting thing to be on the road, perhaps, for them. Many of the Americans in particular, loved coming to Liverpool because this was a kind of mecca for much popular music. And some of the artists I met, I'm trying to think of people, Lynyrd Skynyrd came, they were thought Liverpool was terrific. Alessi, do you remember Alessi? Sparks, This Town Ain't Big Enough. Zootime, is she a new time? The mammals are your favourite time. You buy your water tonight. George Martin came, he had an album out called Beatles to Bond and Bach. And he was wonderful because he had many stories, because he didn't just produce the Beatles, he produced people like Peter Sellers and so on. This is the great thing about having that slot. You could actually hire an electric piano and get it plugged in for when these people came. The best memory for me of that evening session was with Jimmy Webb, a wonderful songwriter. He wrote MacArthur Park and loads of other brilliant songs. Wichita Lineman was one of his. He played as well and sang, and he was terrific. I really warmed to him, and I think he was probably the best of the ones I met. And I was actually given a slot to do classical music with the then principal conductor of the Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, Sir Charles Groves. He was amazing. He would come in, sit down and talk, and we'd introduce the music and play it and so on. And he didn't have any notes. He didn't have any timings. He just talked. He knew exactly how much he had to say. And we were always on time. I had so little editing to do with him. He was extraordinary.
194 Radio City, 24 hours a day, every day. Starts on October 21st at 6 a.m.
I didn't have an accent from Birmingham when I went to Liverpool. I was pretty RP. I still am. I should have a Yorkshire accent, really. But there was no difficulty being embraced, if I can put it that way, by the community. I'm stumbling because I didn't actually have that much contact apart from the occasional charity event where we would go and throw a welly or something in football kit. I didn't do any phone-ins. The others did the phone-ins. So I was pretty much just nattering away on my own with the music and with the visitors. I didn't actually have the direct contact back. But I think it went out well. The figures seemed to be all right. I was reassured that the figures were okay. And I was certainly doing something different because I was given the opportunity to play music other than the top 40, which I have to say I cherish. It's new. I think Radio City was pretty commercially successful, and we were always playing lots of commercials. We were forever swivelling around trying to get cassettes to shove in the cart players. So that seemed to be a good indication we were getting it right. It's a teenage dream to be 17. There was, however, one hiatus. One of the DJs, who will remain nameless, and it wasn't me, had said on air, there is no way we are going to play the Bay City Rollers. They were becoming quite popular then with the younger listeners. As a result, I think it was Arista Records, I can't remember the record label, stopped the campaign. So that was quite a harsh lesson, and I think there were some stern words, and I think from that moment, we had to start acknowledging what was going on in the charts. Whilst I was at Radio City, I was able to talk to a lot of the actors at the Everyman Theatre, and there were some rather famous ones. Jonathan Pryce, you remember him, Cape Fye, Julie Walters. She was a brilliant singer, by the way. I recorded a song at City, on the City studio, written by Gillian's husband, Stanley Reynolds. It was called Subway Summer. I wish I could find a copy of it somewhere. Brilliant. Bill Nye was there, Pete Postlethwaite, Matthew Kelly. These are all brilliant names. And I did find that I was being encouraged to do more of this kind of thing. And I think with a slight shift in emphasis of the station's output, that encouragement diminished, and so did my interest in playing the kind of music that perhaps was commercially more viable. There is a small box article on a front page of the Liverpool Echo in January 1977, which reads, Liverpool loses two Billy Binghams. The Everton manager had been sacked, and I was on my way to Nottingham. We got the sound. At this point, I'd heard word that they were looking for people at Radio Trent. There was a bit of an upheaval there for some reason. The new programme organiser, Neil Spence, had put the word out that they needed new people, so I went. And I didn't really want to go for various reasons. I had a nice girlfriend in Liverpool, but I needed to work. I went over to Nottingham and said, hello, what do you think? Can I come and work here? And I was asked to make a demo down in the off-air studio in Castle Gate. And I have a very vivid memory of sitting there making this demo with John Peters, the legendary John Peters, on the other side of the glass, who came through at one point and gave me a cup of tea.
Have you got to get up every weekday morning?
This lovely big man bowled up with a cup of tea and a biscuit, which I thought was the kindest thing anyone could have possibly done to someone who is slightly anxious making this demo. Anyway, I got the gig. It was a late show, as well as specialist programmes. Now, Neil Spence, very interestingly, wanted to look at specialist music, and he gave me an hour each evening of jazz, folk, rock, classical music, 2 hours of classical music on Sundays. And on Saturdays, we started a punk music show. That was quite a memorable time, I have to say. I was heavily criticised, quite rightly, for tending to play prog rock in the rock section in those specialist hours, and very little heavy metal. I have to say, I still need help enjoying the more extreme heavy metal music. But I'd loved the punk, because this was really all extremely new and exciting and anarchistic. I was carpeted by the managing director, Dennis Maitland, for playing a song by an extraordinary musician called Wayne County and the Electric Chairs. His band was called the Electric Chairs. The song was called, and I will be delicate here, "If You Don't Want To," in quotes, "Have Consensual Sex With Me, Baby, Baby, Sex and Travel Off." If you don't wanna fuck me, baby, baby, fuck off. But the phones lit up afterwards, equally pro and con, and Dennis gave me a very stern talking to the following day. It was after 9 o'clock. I mean, there were no juniors listening. They should have been in bed, tucked up in bed. And I'm certain that Dennis found it very hard to keep a straight face while he was giving me this strict talking to. I was quite convinced that this new regime, this new look to Radio Trent, was to be a successful one. I know it was quite different from what had gone before, but I got the sense from everyone, the other DJs, from Neil Spence, that this was actually going down quite well. It's hopeless. I never look at Rajar figures. I never bothered to look at them. I knew that if there was something wrong, I would be told. I didn't sort of lie awake at night anguishing about what my figures were like. And Castlegate was fortunate in having a very nice public house opposite, the Royal Children, I think it's called. So we'd hang out in there quite a lot. And we all got on extremely well.
Bit of class on the show and a bad time this morning. What do you think, eh? Yes, Leo Sayer. Beautiful ballad. He has a hit record this one. It's called Heart Stop Beating in Time.
Dale Winton was there, as many people probably know. For a time, my specialist shows followed Dale. He was a lovely boy, huge amounts of enthusiasm, very popular with housewives. We became fairly close, met socially quite a lot. I learned a great deal about his social life around Nottingham. He got me on the front page of Gay News once. He invited me to the gay club round the corner from the station after I'd finished a late show about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I went with my then girlfriend, Julie. She and I arrived in the club and we had a drink and we danced a bit, not close up. You know, you didn't dance close up in those days. And she was cropped out of the picture that appeared on Gay News. Dear Dale, what a cheeky boy he was. I inevitably gravitated towards the Nottingham Playhouse, which meant I was able to interview Richard Eyre, who was artistic director there, and some of the actors who appeared there. Tennessee Williams's new play, Vieux Carré, premiered in the UK at the Nottingham Playhouse, and he came to the first night. I interviewed him in his hotel room. He was dressed in a suit. He looked like a Swiss banker. He didn't look anything like the sort of bohemian character I expected. If ever I write an autobiography, I've decided I'm going to call it Tennessee Williams Called Me Honey, because he did. And he was extremely interesting, extremely agreeable, and very pleased with the production. It was an unexpectedly happy time at Trent, part of the Nottingham community, happy to be moving around that beautiful city. I lived in the park, which is also rather nice, so I could walk to work. It was from Trent that I was headhunted to Radio Nottingham, which is a station I once auditioned for when local radio first began and the so-and-sos didn't hire me. Trevor Dann, another legend, another radio legend, had suggested to Tom Beasley, the lovely station manager, that I could sit in for the breakfast show presenter who was on a training course. The best moments at Radio Nottingham, I would say, were presenting a show live from a hot air balloon, 4 hours up in the air, and a live show from Munich the morning after Forest beat Malmo of Sweden to win the European Cup in 1979. That was an exciting time to be in Munich with all the fans and to actually be able to hold up the European Cup myself in Slab Square in Nottingham. The show at Radio Nottingham, the breakfast show, was news. There was no music then. It was news and features, some of which were generated by the journalists, by the newsroom, some of which were live features that were set up beforehand. It's a bit like a Today programme, if you like. In fact, very similar, very much that kind of pattern, although just one presenter. And I loved it. I have to say, I really loved it. And it moved me away from music presentation straight into newsroom and into joining the NUJ, a union card I still hold, and proudly. 6 months was the breakfast show deal at the Radio Nottingham. It turned into 9 months. And it led to a transfer to Newsbeat on Radio 1 in Broadcasting House in London.
Bill Bingham reporting. The government wants to peg public sector pay rises next year to around 6%. They plan to do it by limiting their rate support grant to local authorities. There's been angry reaction.
When
from
I got
the
to London, it was feet first, steep learning curve. It was again another transformation. Newsbeat on Radio 1 had been something fairly light and not particularly tough on the news stories. They were fairly music-based stories, and obviously music items were included in Newsbeat's bulletins. But the emphasis was on the hard news that all the other news outlets were providing. John Hunt was an old school Welsh hack. He turned Newsbeat into a proper news service. The biggest event I remember was when John Lennon was killed in December 1980. We really worked our socks off on that story, as you can imagine.
A Day in the Life by John Lennon, who was murdered in New York early this morning. This is Andrew Turner with the 10:30 news summary. And in New York, hundreds of fans are still gathered outside the home of the former Beatle John Lennon after his murder. New York police have now charged
so
a man
it was mostly Broadcasting House based in Newsbeat, but occasionally you did get out to record an interview with somebody. And I was sent out to interview, I think, an education minister, and forgive me, I've forgotten his name, but he really gave me a tough time, and that, again, contributed to the steep learning curve. You've really got to know your stuff. You've really got to have your facts up your sleeve when you're tangling with ministers and MPs, because they have them and they will challenge yours at any opportunity. Newsbeat Radio 1. The Newsbeat offices were up on the second floor of Broadcasting House, a dedicated space, just like any newsroom, lots of desks, lots of typewriters, and editing machines. Editing, we were constantly cutting with razor blades and tape and sticky tape and so on. We were some way from the actual Radio 1 studios, which didn't really matter too much. The programmes that we did, the live programmes we did at 1 o'clock and 6 o'clock, were done from dedicated studios in Broadcasting House, some floors away from where the jocks were sitting. So actually we had very little contact with them. We occasionally saw them. We saw them socially, perhaps. But we were very much like the main Radio 4 newsroom. We weren't far away. We were on the same floor as the Radio 4 newsroom. And we had much contact with them, inevitably, because they were keeping us supplied with our copy and audio, the audio that we didn't actually go and get ourselves. The individuals involved in Newsbeat in those days were proper journalists. They'd served their time. Frank Partridge was one of them. He went on to be one of the main presenters of Sky News.
This is the BBC Home Service. It has just been announced from Buckingham Palace that Her Royal Highness Princess Elizabeth, Duchess of Edinburgh, was safely delivered of a prince at 9:14 p.m.
When I grew up listening to the wireless, the people who read the news were people like John Snagg, in very measured tones, with mellifluous voices, and I think I would have admired that a lot and would have liked to have had a similar instrument. And, yeah, there is a tendency, especially these days, to mock the actor who wants to be a newsreader. I have to say, there are some bloody awful newsreaders around these days. There are some extremely good ones. And I suspect they all have acting training of some kind. Because the point of telling the news, in my view, is to let people know what the story's about. And if you read it in the same way, with the same emphasis, halfway through and come down on a falling cadence at a full stop, then you have to sort of make more of an effort to understand the story. But if someone is explaining it to you because they understand it, and that's the point, to read the news, you've got to understand what it's about, then I think it's preferable. But I know I'm in a minority these days. I did actually get to read the news on Radio 4 because I moved from Newsbeat over to Radio 4 Continuity and became one of the announcers. That means I'm one of the elite few who have read the shipping forecast. Dogger, Fisher, German Bite, Winds, Light to Variable. Actually, it all sounds very nice and calm, but it's terrifying because you have to get the timing exactly right. You can't go off script. You can't interpret it. You've got to actually say what's there. And you've got to know exactly where you are as you're reading it so you don't crash Big Ben. You tear off some paper from a teleprinter, examine it very carefully so you know what it means. It's not actually written in straight English. I mean, it's in English, but you have to add any prepositions. And what you have to do, I used to read it through three or four times and just make a note on this piece of paper what the timing was at that point so that I knew I could glance up at the clock and see whether I was too fast or too slow and pace it accordingly. And I actually did read a couple of bulletins. Peter Donaldson became a good pal. And I have to say, I used to meet Peter for a drink, a pint or two, the Yorkshire Grey, until only a month or two before he died. And I do miss him, I must say. But he was a good pal, and he taught me loads as well. He had a wonderful voice.
BBC News. This is Peter Donaldson.
Radio 4 news bulletins were written by the journalists. You would sit there and you would be handed a piece of paper with the news stories on and the cues for any audio that was going to be played. You didn't play any of it. There was an engineer on the other side of the glass who would play in any tapes and so on, which is fine. But again, you need to prepare. And the earlier you get that piece of paper is always the better. I remember Laurie McMillan. There is a recording of Laurie McMillan somewhere where she is about to read the 6 o'clock bulletin and she's going through it. And she's reading some of it aloud, and she's been quite rude, quite gently rude about how it's been written, and she's changing it to make it more sensible. Laurie McMillan, she's died as well. She's someone who's gone. She was a sweetheart. We got on extremely well. I don't know why. It's to do with humour, I think. We laughed a lot. I was on tour some years later in a production of Death of a Salesman. It was in 2001, and I knew she was seriously ill, and I did phone her once in a while. I phoned her to say we'd be in Exeter, which is not far from Okehampton, where she lived, and we'd be in the theatre the following week. And I was ringing on a Monday the week ahead, and she said she'd booked tickets for her and her husband, and she sounded really cheerful, but she was breathless. She sounded breathless. And she died 4 years later, a week before she was coming to the show. Dear Laurie, I read a poem at her funeral. Several of us did. A lot of other announcers were there. And she was really, really quite a girl, quite a wonderful and brilliant voice.
So on behalf of all of us here on Radio 4, this is Laurie McMillan wishing you a quiet night. Good night.
After a couple of years, I was invited to meet Ron Onions, who was the boss of LBC, because they were looking for more voices, more presenters. And it was one of the nicest interviews I've ever had. And he hired me and got me to be the regular joint presenter of the Drive Time show with David Loyne, who's now a distinguished BBC correspondent. That also meant reading IRN bulletins throughout the afternoon and the early evening.
On 95.8 FM, this is Capital Radio.
The Midday News, this is Bilbingham.
The Cunard Shipping Company is taking legal action to try to stop crewmen on the QE2 going on strike when it docks in Australia this morning.
An uncomfortable story associated with that. I did at one point have to go up to a bank. I had to go to the bank and stood in line waiting to do whatever it was, and noticed that the time was getting close to the 1 o'clock. And I just abandoned the bank work and rushed. I ran back to Gough Square to the studios and sat down about 30 seconds before 1 o'clock and had the script put in my hand, and I was pretty well speechless. This is not a habit you should encourage in newsreaders. They should be well and truly calm some 20 minutes before they're due to read, and I'm afraid I'm quite embarrassed about how it came out. I know that afterwards the phones did light up and people were wondering whether I was ill, and it's no surprise. IRN was nationwide sent out to all the independent stations, and it was, I think, a very good service. They had a terrific newsroom. Gough Square was filled with some of the best journalists.
Mr. Speaker, sir, the House meets this Saturday to respond to a situation of great gravity. We are here because for the first time for many years, British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign
5 o'clock,
power.
This is Bill Bingham. Argentina has invaded the Falkland Islands, and its marines have taken control of the colony, which has been in British hands for almost 150 years. There are no reports of casualties, either among the 1,800 English-speaking islanders or among the small force of marines there to protect them.
One of the best pieces of radio journalism, I think, was during the Falklands War. I happened to be on shift when the official announcement came in 1982 that we had declared war on Argentina over the Falklands. It was quite a time. Ron Onions had got one of our ace reporters, Kim Sabido, onto the SS Canberra, which was part of the task force sailing into the southern Atlantic. Kim sent back some of the best reports that you would have heard at the time, which were in sharp contrast to what the MOD's Ian MacDonald was giving us in his slow, almost dictation speed delivery. I heard MacDonald described at the time as a man with the delivery and charisma of a speak-your-weight machine. But this was a very important time in our history. Mrs. Thatcher was at her peak. We were at war with someone else. It was divisive because there were those saying that we should let the Falklands go. What the hell? They're tiny little islands, miles from here, a long way, the other side of the earth. What do we need with them?
The whole thing at the moment lit by only the moon. Again, more gunfire. Flashes of red light. And every now and then, of course, trace the red embers which flash across the sky, bouncing off rocks, and on several occasions missing.
I have two mementos of that time. One is the map of the Falklands we had up in the newsroom in Gough Square, so we could see where Kim and Ian MacDonald were talking about. The second, I must tell you this wonderful story about the second memento, which I still cherish. It's a tie. Paul Maurice was our defence expert, and he was understandably, like everyone else, irritated by the slow dribble of news of what was going on in the South Atlantic. He and some of the other correspondents hanging around the MOD commissioned some ties, dark blue, covered with a design incorporating an anchor representing the Naval Task Force, a penguin, the Southern Oceans, and a question mark. Easy to see what that represented. John Knott was Defence Minister at the time, and I remember with huge delight watching him storm off the set of a BBC television news programme hosted by Robin Day and tearing the little microphone off his tie as he went. He was wearing one of our ties.
But why should the public on this issue, as regards the future of the Royal Navy, believe you, a transient here today and, if I may say so, gone tomorrow politician, rather than a senior officer of many years?
I'm fed up with this interview, really. It's such a ridiculous ruling.
Thank you, Mr. Knott.
One of the things about reading a bulletin for IRN is that you've got to get your timing spot on. Otherwise, you crash into something that they're doing locally. So you learn to be good at keeping an eye on the clock, and you speed up as well. And that's no bad thing. I think if you crack on through the news bulletin, as long as you're still clear and making the right emphasis here and there, then it's good. And I think I got okay at doing that without actually, I hope, losing too much of the clarity that sometimes you don't get these days. I've got a little story about Dickie Arbiter. Dickie Arbiter went on to be Charles and Diana's press officer, but he was one of our newsreaders presenters at Gough Square. He had occasional difficulty reading script. He had a lovely voice, but he did sometimes get it wrong. There's a tape somewhere where he says, "It's Dickie Arbiter, I'm 1 o'clock." This unfortunately meant he was sometimes referred to as Artie Dickbiter.
Independent Radio News, it's 9:03.
I stayed with LBC IRN on and off quite a lot. I was able to get freelance shifts with them because, you know, I had a certain heritage and familiarity to the audience. So I was able to do other work as well, occasional acting jobs during this time, and still get some shifts, which was very helpful, I have to say. LBC changed owners and moved home a couple of times over the years, and this connection was good to keep, I must say. It was really useful by the 1990s, the early 2000s, because by then I got myself an agent, an acting agent, which was helpful. I was never going to be big time, but I was getting the best of both worlds.
And this is Blue Danube Radio. Sounds great.
During the 1980s and early 90s, I travelled to Vienna from time to time for what you can only describe as busman's holidays at Blue Danube Radio. Vienna is very proud of its international connections. It has a huge United Nations building on the river with a huge staff. Many of the staff don't speak German, or don't speak much German anyway. The BBC equivalent in Austria, Österreichischer Rundfunk, or the ORF, decided they'd provide news programmes and subsequently music programmes as well in English. Since Austria wasn't then in the EU, we could only stay for 3 weeks at a time, but it was well paid, and Vienna was a wonderful place to enjoy hospitality in Gasthauses, Heurigen, bars, restaurants, where a night out can be a casual meal, or you can be really fancy and dress up for the opera and then dinner under the stars. I was also asked to do weekend breakfast on Jazz FM. I really enjoyed doing that, I must say, because it's my kind of music. It was my bad luck to be on shift when the news came in that Miles Davis had died, Saturday the 28th of September 1991. I was entirely on my own in the building. I couldn't get into the music library to grab some of his discs. But I did what I could. I just had one disc in the studio, so I queued it and alternated him with what other music I had there. And I wish I could have just given blanket Miles Davis on that day, but it was such a nightmare trying to cue one disc whilst trying to talk to people about this very sad news. Around this time, I was still doing LBC shifts, freelance shifts. LBC had split in two. It was now called London News and News Talk. It was based in Chrysalis premises near Shepherd's Bush. It was a bit knackering, I have to say. Some bright spark had the idea we should read standing up. This is because they did this in the United States. It's more dynamic, man. I'm glad to say that by the time LBC IRN moved to ITN's building in Gray's Inn Road, working arrangements are a bit more sensible and we could at least sit down to do our job.
Hello, this is David Hamilton, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to a brand new station for the West Midlands, Saga 105.7 FM. We'll be playing melodic popular records from the 40s to the present day, and if that's your kind of music, then I'm
back into music presenting around this time after a very nice young man called Paul Roby invited me to join Saga FM in Birmingham. I have to say, I resisted him at first due to what you could call a misplaced sense of youth. I wasn't ready to be associated with old people. I was still only in my 60s, okay. But there were a number of very distinguished and enlightened individuals running things at Saga, and I really enjoyed myself there. The music policy was wide-ranging. We were able to make some really good feature programmes, and the guests queued up. I'm afraid Saga was eventually bought up by GMG, and a dreary shadow fell over the West Midlands. It's still there. Saga was a really warm and, I think, energetic station, whereas Smooth is... It's only smooth. It's just smooth and rather dull.
But now you should get as much kip as you can. There's no time to mess about with keypads and teletext now. Remember, it's Monday tomorrow. You're already 1 hour's sleep short because the clocks went on last night, I beg your pardon. You may not be able to get a line in the morning. Anyway, sleep well. From all the Charlotte Street crowd, see you tomorrow. This is Bill Bingham wishing you good night.
All the freelance work I was doing around this time overlapped. I was able to keep bulletins going and the reporting and so on with Sky News Radio in the big television centre in Austerlee. The great thing about Sky was that they had, and still have, great facilities, very gifted staff. We had access to all their output, which meant our bulletins could be refreshed every half hour. It was hard work, but it didn't matter. Andy Ivey was the editor, cycling-obsessed man, but he had a good, enlightened sense of how Sky News Radio should be. And again, at this point, many radio stations, especially overnight, were automated. So if your bulletin overran by half a second or a second, then you'd lose half a word, a couple of words even sometimes. And it did happen, but fortunately not often. More recently, I've been acting and performing Shakespeare, new work on stage, and occasionally on short films. Nothing big time yet, but you never know. Mr. Spielberg may ring.
Good morning, Groovers. That's got you off to a nice start this Saturday morning, 20th of August. And it's going to be a bit dull today, I'm sorry to tell you. A little bit of rain, but the temperature will reach 21 degrees. This is Bill. Good morning.
Trent veteran Jeff Cooper offered a very interesting diversion. Jeff Cooper was the rock show presenter on Radio Trent. He persuaded John Peters, Guy Morris, Ron Coles, few others, and me to resurrect the good old days online. There's an odd discipline to this kind of work because links are pre-recorded by us and then uploaded the previous day and automatically slotted into a computer-driven schedule alongside the music and any features and commercials and so on. I didn't find it entirely easy. I have to admit this because despite my acting skills, it was hard to not respond to music that I wasn't actually listening to. The thing about being a music presenter is that you're kind of infected by the tone of the piece you're playing. So I had to sometimes try and achieve that artificially by listening to it and then doing the link. Another online service I spent several years on was Monocle 24. The Canadian magazine entrepreneur Tyler Brulé was obsessed with the BBC's World Service, so he invented one of his own. Monocle 24. He hired some really good people to run it, and I enjoyed working in extremely pleasant surroundings. He has very good taste, very good furniture taste, Mr. Brulé. I was asked to be Father Christmas one year and introduce the day's programmes as a cheery, fat self-indulger.
Ho, 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 hello! This holiday season, I will be sharing all sorts of Christmas presents with you here on Monocle 24. My good friends, the radio elves at Midori House...
These days, I spend my time with a really great organisation. It's the Migration Museum, where we collect and tell stories of the movement of people to and from the UK, a highly topical theme these days. And this is where my interviewing audio editing skills are put to good use. 2 years ago, we staged an exhibition from the Calais jungle. I made 5 trips over to Calais and came back with several hours of recordings, art, abandoned tents, great many new friends. The exhibition was called Call Me By My Name. The thing about the Migration Museum, the stories we tell aren't just contemporary ones. We describe migration through the ages. I was able to play and deliver a speech for the museum written by Shakespeare for a play about Sir Thomas More urging anti-immigrant rioters to calm down. They'd been attacking Spanish and French strangers, as they called them, on May Day in 1517. So on the anniversary, the 500th anniversary last year in May, on May the 1st, I was able to recreate, well, in a very small way, what may have happened on what was known in history as Evil May Day. There had been a few deaths on that occasion. Thomas More was the under-sheriff of London then, a sort of chief constable, if you like, and he succeeded, for a time at least, in quelling the riot. And I gave this speech just a few yards from where the riot actually took place in 1517, very close to St Paul's, to some slightly startled passers-by. The thing about migration is that it's been going on for decades. We're all affected by migration in some way. I guarantee we all have migration in our family histories. I have French and German ancestors. If we remind everyone of our migration heritage, it ought to completely undermine racism. I really hope so. I really hope it does. And that's what occupies me full-time these days.
And we had all Muslim neighbours, and we lived as one family with them. We didn't know that we were any different from Muslims. We were all eating with them and playing with them and socialising with them. But suddenly, on the night of 14th August, after...
I'm so lucky to have had such a varied career. It has taken its toll. I have to say, when I moved to Liverpool from Birmingham, it meant the end of my marriage. Although my dear ex-wife Mary, who I still have contact with and we're still pals, because we had three children, so you don't lose contact with the mother of your children. She was enlightened and generous enough to allow me to go and visit whenever I wanted, and in fact, pretty well every weekend I would spend back with the family. And tough for her, tough for us both, but tough for her. But we survived, and the children survived, and we get on extremely well. I don't think I'm entirely to blame. I'm not blaming Mary here, but I don't think it's necessarily a reason to feel guilty. I did, and I've tried to shake it off, because guilt is no use to you. It's no help. It's not constructive. But I'm able to look after myself, and that's what I've done throughout work and all the many friends and relationships that have happened. I've lived in London since 1980, the 1st of January 1980, and it's been where most of the work has been, inevitably. But the effect that this work can have on people is quite profound. I mean, for a start, the shift work is knackering, and it affects relationships. It's affected relationships of mine over the years, and it can affect your health. So the sensible thing is to climb the ladder as quickly as you can so that you can determine your own hours. But I still feel how fortunate I've been to have such a variety of work and to be able to do two careers, parallel careers, if you like, of theatre and so on, and radio. And I have to say, I think radio is probably my first love. Radio in the 21st century isn't so much different, I suppose, from what it was in the latter half of the 20th century. I don't listen to the music stations much, I'm afraid. I do listen to Radio 4 pretty well all the time. And I've noticed how it's changed over the years, and I'm turning into an old git in many ways, and will turn and abuse the radio if something happens. I hear something, some really bad English. There is some awful English at the moment. I mean, one of my beefs is the way people who are contributing to a programme, perhaps the Today programme, when they say, the presenter says, good morning, thank you for coming in, and they say, thank you for having me. Now, what's that? What does that mean? Thank you for... Are you there because you're promoting something? You're being... That irritates me quite a lot. Thank you for having me. I don't know if the people who train contributors are telling them to do that. I have a feeling not. I think it's another ghastly Americanism. And starting a sentence with so is always very irritating. So I'm turning into a sad old git here. But radio's diverse. Thank goodness it's diverse. And of course we have the internet. And isn't that a brilliant invention? Because you can listen to anything you want. I have to tell you, there is one radio station I really like. It's called Radio Hermitage. It comes from St. Petersburg. Divinosta Iadin FM. That means 90.1 FM in Russian. It's about the only Russian I know, apart from Spasiba. So you can do that, and I think the future is bright. It's diverse, but it's bright.
Радио Эрмитаж. Волна спокойствия и комфорта. 91 FM.
If I were to be asked where I was happiest in my radio work, I think I'd probably say at Radio City, because it was so thrilling and we were given such a free rein to explore things, and we did become popular, because I know we did make an impression.
For the very first time, this is 194 Radio City, broadcasting to Merseyside.
I don't think there's anything I would have done differently work-wise. If I'd explored theatre and so on, I might have... Oh, I don't know. I've never particularly wanted to be famous. I've wanted to be admired in the sense that I'd like people to realise I make an effort to do good work. Not admiration so much as recognition that I want what I do to be effective and enjoyed. So it's not the fame. I've never had fame anyway of any nature, any particular nature. Some nice letters from various people over the years, but nothing. No being pigeonholed in the supermarket, and I imagine that's not much fun anyway. So I would imagine the path I've trodden has been a good one, and I don't think I would particularly change it. I would just like to have been better at what I did do. I would like to be remembered as thoughtful, as being thoughtful and considerate. I mean, all those nice squidgy things that people say, but I would like people to think that I was considerate, and I have never been interested in attacking and pillorying. In fact, that was a bit of journalism I could never quite deal with comfortably, having to go and attack someone and challenge them hard. If someone told me to go away in four-letter words, then I would more often than not do. I would never stick a foot in the door particularly. So I would like people to think I was thoughtful, and that I had some interesting things to tell them.